At intervals, the high and wealthy civilization of the Roman Empire was, of course, subjected to attempted pillage by small and hungry robber bands without its boundaries. But that had nothing to do with the barbaric recruitment of the Roman army, save when such bands were caught and incorporated. The army was always ready at a moment's order to cut such foreign raiders to pieces, and always did so successfully. The portion of the army chosen to repel, cut up, and sell into slavery a marauding band of Slavs or Germans or Celts always had Celts or Slavs or Germans present in large numbers among its own soldiery. But no tie of blood interfered with the business. To consider such a thing would have been inconceivable to the opponents on either side. The distinction was not between speech and speech, still less between vague racial customs. It was a distinction between the imperial service on the one side against the outer, unrecognized savage on the other. As the machinery of government grew weak through old age, and as the recruitment of the army from barbarians and the large proportion of auxiliary regular forces began to weaken that basis of the whole state, the tendency of pillaging bands to break in past the frontiers into the cultivated lands and the wealth of the cities grew greater and greater, but it never occurred to them to attack the empire as such. All they wanted was permission to enjoy the life which was led within it, and to abandon the wretched conditions to which they were compelled outside its boundaries. Sometimes they were transformed from pillagers to soldiers by an offer extended by the Roman authorities. More often they snatched a raid when there was for the moment no good garrison in their neighborhood. Then a Roman force would march against them, and if they were not quick at getting away, would cut them to pieces. But with the progress of the central decline, the attacks of these small bands on the frontiers became more frequent. Frontier towns came to regard such attacks as a permanent peril, and to defend themselves against them. Little groups of raiders would sometimes traverse great districts from end to end, and whether in the form of pirates from the sea or of war bands on land, the ceaseless attempts to enjoy or to loot, but principally to enjoy, the conditions that civilization offered, grew more and more persistent. It must not be imagined, of course, that civilization had not occasionally to suffer then, as it had had to suffer at intervals for 1,000 years past, the attacks of really large and organized barbaric armies. Footnote. For instance, a century and a half before the breakdown of central government, the Goths, a barbaric group, largely German, had broken in and ravaged in a worse fashion than their successors in the 5th century. Thus, in the year 404, driven by the pressure of an eastern invasion upon their own forests, a vast barbaric host, under one Radagaisus, pushed into Italy. The men bearing arms alone were estimated, in a time well used to soldiery and to such estimates, at 200,000. But those 200,000 were wiped out. The barbarians were always wiped out when they attempted to come as conquerors. Stilicho, a typical figure, for he was himself of barbaric descent, yet in the regular Roman service, cut to pieces one portion of them. The rest surrendered and were sold off and scattered as slaves. Immediately afterwards, you have a violent quarrel between various soldiers who desire to capture the imperial power. The story is fragmentary and somewhat confused. Now one usurper is blamed, and now another. But the fact common to all is that with the direct object of usurping power, a Roman general calls in barbarian bands of pillagers, all sorts of small groups, Franks, Suevians, Vandals, to cross the Rhine into Gaul, not as barbarian conquerors, but as allies, to help in a civil war. The succeeding generation has left us ample evidence of the results. It presents us with documents which do not give a picture of a ruined province by any means, only of a province which has been traversed in certain directions by the march of barbarian robber bands, who afterwards disappeared, largely in fighting among themselves. We have later the very much more serious business of the Mongol Attila and his Huns, leading the great outer mass of Germans and Slavs into the empire on an enormous raid. In the middle of the 5th century, 50 years after the destruction of Radagasius, these Asiatics, leading more numerous other barbaric dependents of theirs from the Germanies and the eastern Slavonic lands, penetrated for two brief moments into northern Italy and eastern Gaul. The end of that business, infinitely graver though it was than the raids that came before it, is just what one might have expected. The regular and auxiliary disciplined forces of the empire destroy the barbarian power near Chalons, and the last and worst of the invasions is wiped out as thoroughly as had been all the others. In general, the barbaric eruptions into the empire failed wholly as soon as imperial troops could be brought up to oppose them. What, then, were the supposed barbaric successes? What was the real nature of the action of Alaric, for instance, and his sack of Rome? And how, later, do we find local kings in the place of the Roman governors? The real nature of the action of men like Alaric is utterly different from the imaginary picture with which the old picturesque popular history recently provided us. That false history gives us the impression of a barbarian chieftain gathering his clan to a victorious assault on Rome. Consider the truth upon Alaric, and contrast it with this imaginary picture. Alaric was a young noble of Gothic blood, but from birth a Roman. At 18 years of age, he was put by the court in command of a small Roman auxiliary force, originally recruited from the Goths. He was as much a Roman officer, as incapable of thinking of himself in any other terms than those of the Roman army, as any other one of his colleagues about the throne. He had his commission from the Emperor Theodosius, and when Theodosius marched into Gaul against the usurper Eugenius, he counted Alaric's division as among the most faithful of his army. It so happened, moreover, that those few original auxiliaries, mainly Goths by race, were nearly all destroyed in the campaign. Alaric survived. The remnant of his division was recruited, we know not how, but probably from all kinds of sources, to its old strength. It was still called Gothic, though now of the most mixed origin, and it was still commanded by himself in his character as a Roman general. Alaric, after this service to the emperor, was rewarded by further military dignities in the Roman military hierarchy. He was ambitious of military titles and of important command, as are all soldiers. Though still under 20 years of age and only a commander of auxiliaries, he asks for the title of Magister Militum, with the dignity that accompanied that highest of military posts. The emperor refuses it. One of the ministers thereupon begins to plot with Alaric, and suggests to him that he might gather other auxiliary troops under his command and make things uncomfortable for his superiors. Alaric rebels, marches through the Balkan Peninsula into Thessaly in Greece, and down into the Peloponnesus. The regulars march against him, according to some accounts, and beat him back into Albania. There ends his first adventure. It is exactly like that of 100 other Roman generals in the past, and so are his further adventures. He remains in Albania at the head of his forces and makes peace with the government, still enjoying a regular commission from the emperor. He next tries a new adventure to serve his ambition in Italy, but his army is broken to pieces at Palencia by the armies in Italy, under a general, by the way, as barbaric in mere descent as was Alaric, but, like Alaric, wholly Roman in training and ideas. The whole thing is a civil war between various branches of the Roman service, and is motived, like all the Roman civil wars for hundreds of years before, by the ambitions of generals. Alaric does not lose his commission even after his second adventure. He begins to intrigue between the western and eastern heads of the Roman Empire. The great invasion under Radagasius interrupts this civil war. That invasion was for Alaric, of course, as for any other Roman officer, an invasion of barbaric enemies. That these enemies should be called by this or that barbaric name is quite indifferent to him. They come from outside the empire, and are therefore, in his eyes, cattle. He helps to destroy them, and destroyed they are, promptly and thoroughly. When the brief invasion was over, Alaric had the opportunity to renew the civil wars within the empire, and asks for certain arrears of pay that were due to him. Stilicho, the great rival general, himself, by the way, a Vandal in descent, admitted Alaric's right to arrears of pay, but just at that moment there occurred an obscure palace intrigue which was based, like all the real movements of the time, on differences of religion, not of race. Stilicho, suspected of attempting to restore paganism, is killed. In the general confusion, certain of the families of the auxiliaries garrisoned in Italy are massacred by the non-military population. As Alaric is a general in partial rebellion against the imperial authority, these auxiliaries join him. The total number of Alaric's men was at this moment very small. They were perhaps 30,000. There was no trace of nationality about them. They were simply a body of discontented soldiers. They had not come from across the frontier. They were not invaders. They were part of the long-established and regular garrisons of the empire. And for that matter, many garrisons and troops of equally barbaric origin sided with the regular authorities in the quarrel. Alaric marches on Rome with this disaffected Roman army, claiming that he has been defrauded of his due and salary, and leaning upon the popularity of the dead Stilicho, whose murder he says he will avenge. His 30,000 claimed the barbarian slaves within the city, and certain sums of money which had been the pretext and motive of his rebellion. As a result of this action, the emperor promises Alaric his regular salary as a general, and a district which he may not only command, but plant with his few followers. Even in the height of his success, Alaric again demands the thing which was nearest his heart, the supreme and entirely Roman title of Magister Militum, the highest post in the hierarchy of military advancement. But the emperor again refuses to give that. Alaric again marches on Rome, a Roman officer followed by a rebellious Roman army. He forces the Senate to make Attalus nominal emperor of the West, and Attalus to give him the desired title, his very craving which is most significant of the Roman character of the whole business. Alaric then quarrels with his puppet, deprives him of the insignia of the empire, and sends them to Honorius. Quarrels again with Honorius, re-enters Rome and pillages it, marches to southern Italy, dies, and his small army is dismembered. There is the story of Alaric, as it appears from documents, and as it was in reality. There is the truth underlying the false picture with which most educated men were recently provided by the anti-Roman bias of recent history. Certainly, the story of Alaric's discontent with his salary and the terms of his commission, his raiding marches, his plunder of the capital, shows how vastly different was the beginning of the 5th century from the society of 300 years before. It is symptomatic of the change, and it could only have been possible at a moment when central government was at last breaking down. But it is utterly different in motive and in social character from the vague customary conception of a vast barbarian invasion, led by a German warlord, pouring over the Alps and taking Roman society and its capital by storm. It has no relation to such a picture. If all this be true of the dramatic adventure of Alaric, which has so profoundly affected the imagination of mankind, it is still truer of the other contemporary events which false history might twist into a conquest of the empire by the barbarian. There was no such conquest. All that happened was an internal transformation of Roman society, in which the chief functions of local government fell to the heads of local auxiliary forces in the Roman army. As these auxiliary forces were now mainly barbaric, so were the personalities of the new local governors. I have only dealt with the particular case of Alaric because it is the most familiar and the most generally distorted, a test, as it were, of my theme. But what is true of him is true of all other auxiliaries in the armies, even of the probably Slavonic Vandals. These did frankly loot a province, North Africa, and they alone of the imperial, of the auxiliary troops, did revolt against the imperial system and defy it for a century. But the Vandals themselves were already, before their adventure, a part of the imperial forces. They were but a nucleus for a mixed host made up of all the varied elements of rebellion present in the country, and their experiment in separation went down at last forever before the imperial armies. Meanwhile, the North African society on which the rebels lived, and which, with their various recruits, Moors, escaped slaves, criminals, they maladministered and half-ruined, was and remained Roman. In the case of local Italian government, the case is quite clear. There was never any question of invasion or conquest. Odoacer held a regular Roman commission. He was a Roman soldier. Theodoric supplanted him by leave of, and actually under orders from, the emperor. The last and greatest example, the most permanent, Gaul, tells the same story. The Burgundians are auxiliaries regularly planted after imploring the aid of the empire and permission to settle. Clovis, the Belgian Fleming, fights no imperial army. His forebears were Roman officials. His little band of perhaps 8,000 men was victorious in a small and private civil war, which made him master in the north over other rival generals. He defended the empire against the eastern barbaric German tribes. He rejoiced in the titles of consul and patrician. There was no destruction of Roman society. There was no breach of continuity in the main institutions of what was now the Western Christian world. There was no considerable admixture in these local civil wars of German, Slav, or outer Celtic blood. No appreciable addition, at least, to the large amount of such blood which, through the numerous soldiers and much more numerous slaves, had already been incorporated with the population of the Roman world. But, in the course of this transformation, in the 5th and 6th centuries, local government did fall into the hands of those who happened to command the main local forces of the Roman army, and these were, by descent, barbarian, because the army had become barbarian in its recruitment. Why local government yet gradually succeeded the old centralized imperial government, and how, in consequence, there slowly grew up the modern nations, we will next examine. End of chapter 3.